The following is a production of BYU Broadcasting in cooperation with the Brigham Young University Division of Continuing Education.
Though they are relatively new genres in the long, rich tradition of Western literature, science fiction and fantasy have taken the publishing and the cinematic worlds by storm in the last few decades. Nearly everyone who reads or occasionally steps into a movie theater is familiar with the mega-selling fantasies Star Wars, Harry Potter, The Lord of the Rings, and Star Trek, and people flock to read or see them primarily because they're just so downright fun. All of these multi-episode epics have their moral and philosophical profundity, however, even if that's not what we're necessarily out to find when we head for the Megaplex on a Friday night or plop into a comfy chair to reread our favorite Harry Potter novel. Some of these series can also be serious when it comes to their science. The famous sci-fi fantasy writers Isaac Asimov, Arthur C. Clarke, and Michael Crichton were real legitimate scientists first before they also became authors, and their detailed, concrete, verisimilitudinous accounts of space exploration, Martian colonies, killer viruses poised to wipe out all of humanity, or killer dinosaurs poised to wipe out a really cool theme park get much of their mimetic power from the obvious intellectual foundation their authors possess. I don't know whether J.K. Rowling's played professional Quidditch before turning to authorship, but I confess that the way she writes about the high-flying game makes me think that she may have. Our guests today on Thinking Aloud are a Spanish novelist who is fast becoming a literary star in his native Spain, and the BYU professor who was the first to discover him from an academic point of view. Trained as an anthropologist and biologist, and widely traveled to the point that it seems almost extreme, Fernando J. López del Oso combines biological science, jungle exploration, Mesoamerican history, microbial mystery, and the ability to craft intense edge-of-your-seat chase scenes to a degree that has book critics and popular audiences raving. It's a pleasure to have both him and his astute critical cheerleader, Professor Dale Pratt, with us in our studios today. This is Mark Burns, sitting in for Marcus Smith on Thinking Aloud. Our guest today on Thinking Aloud is Fernando J. López del Oso, a writer from Spain. He was originally born in Madrid in 1974, now lives with his wife in Barcelona. His father was a famous TV personality who covered the mysterious and parapsychology and was a well-known figure in Spain. Those themes enter into the work that he's doing now. Fernando has a science background. He studied biology at the Universidad Complutense, which is one of the most prestigious universities in Spain. He has several novels already, several essays as well, and is most well-known for having won a prestigious academic and literary prize in Spain. It's the Premio Minotauro in 2009 for his novel El Templo de la Luna, or the Temple of the Moon, which won the prize that's similar to the Nebula or Hugo in the U.S., given to the best science fiction or fantasy novel published during that year. Our other guest today is Fernando's host on campus, Professor Dale Pratt, professor of Spanish and comparative literature at BYU. He's currently writing about proto-humans and post-humans in Spanish literature and, in a sense, discovered Fernando's work as the first serious academic reader of his novel Yeti and has arranged for the English translation of that work. So both of you, welcome to Thinking Aloud.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Fernando, I have two questions for you to start. One is related to your background. I saw that you were a biologist to begin with. How was it that you ended up as a writer?
Actually, I began to write a scientific divulgation. And when I have the opportunity to begin to write a narrative, I thought it was some kind of natural movement. And, well, I did it pretty comfortable.
So you made the transition from biology as a writer of research into novels. They seem to be much different styles to me.
Yeah, well, actually they are, but I always love to read a lot, so the pass from essay to narrative is, well, just a kind of to put a lot of hours in the computer and then it flows. It's different, but it's more interesting, it's more fun for me.
And I assume that especially for a writer of science fiction type of work, that it might be actually good to have a background in the writing of biology and biological research in the sense that it may temper your prose, I think, to some degree, right? Or change it. Do you write differently, do you think, having come out of that background, than you would have had you been an English major?
Yeah.
Would be the equivalent in the United States, or a Spanish major there.
Yeah, and actually in those days in the lecture, a lot of people asked me about this, and how long did you prepare the technical background of your novel Yeti, for example? And I said, well, it's hard to say because I study anthropology in the university, and I have been talking about science news for a lot of years. So a lot of these kind of things are always in my mind. So when I began to imagine a history for a novel, all those elements become out from my mind, and they imbricate with the rest of the history.
So the answer is, how long did you do background for this novel? The answer would be 35 years.
Yes.
Or something like that. Right? Part of who you are and what you know. Dale, let me ask you that same question. Are there elements of a different kind of prose style, do you think, in Spanish, from a novelist who has had the kind of interesting and in some ways unusual writing background that Fernando has?
I do. Many contemporary novelists in Spain, you pick up a novel and there's the Civil War, the Spanish Civil War, which happened, 80 years ago. And it's still a very deep scar in Spain. They're still dealing with questions of historical memory. But the science fiction writers whom I read, they may have moved on. Some of them deal with themes of memory. And so that you can find interesting insights into, say, the memories of the Civil War, how we treat the Spanish Civil War. But they have new metaphors, new tools for looking at things. Fernando's work is completely new. It's very fresh. And he has these adventure stories. He has two different adventurers, two different characters that he sort of alternates in his books. One is sort of an Indiana Jones kind of figure, and the other is a... Well, Mario is sort of he's the Incredible Hulk. Actually, he's a weightlifter sort of fellow who also has a PhD in biology. And so it's kind of fun to watch him work. But the science does appear, you might call it hard science fiction. There are these moments when it comes up and it's perfectly plausible. There's nothing fanciful about what he's trying to do and what he's talking about.
And what do you mean by hard science fiction? I'm going to ask you that and then see if Fernando agrees.
Yeah, I'm calling Fernando a science fiction writer, and I don't think he would classify himself, so he might be mad.
But, thriller was the term.
Techno thriller is the one I really like. But, hard science fiction is a type of science fiction that, traditionally today, now science fiction has evolved over the last 100 years, but something that's fairly plausible. There's very careful explanations of the science involved, or the possible science involved in, say, creating the time travel or the evolution of a retrovirus or something like that. H.G. Wells has no science in his very famous science fiction books. I guess he does in The Island of Dr. Moreau, but nothing else. And then we have figures like Greg Bear or to some degree Michael Crichton, say in The Andromeda Strain, a little bit of explanation of what they're doing. There's another Spanish writer, Leon Arsenal, who does some hard science fiction, and a writer who just appeared on the scene, Eva Garcia Sainz, she has a couple of chapters that are very, very plausible, and she did lots of research into it. Other folks, say like Larry Niven or Ben Bova, people like that will have interesting ideas and use metaphors, but there'll be no explanation at all.
Yeah. And I know that there are writers in the American tradition like Asimov, who was a real scientist, and even Michael Crichton as well, who I think dropped out of Harvard Medical School, if I'm not mistaken, and has made a lot more money doing what he does now than he ever would have as a doctor, and has been, wildly successful in many ways. So, Fernando, let me follow up on that question and ask you the same thing. Do you consider yourself to be more of a science fiction writer or a scientific techno thriller writer than other people perhaps attempting to write in the same genre might be. And as I say that, I will say it just occurs to me that one of the critics who commented online about your work said that it was more science than fiction, which I think is a terse way of saying what Dale just expressed as well, that it's heavy on the science relative to other people writing in the same genre. Could you comment on that?
Well, it has some science in it, but other readers told me that they can't sleep because they can't stop reading, and it's not about the science only. Well, actually, I don't know what kind of writer am I. Because the last novel I'm writing is black. I don't know if this word is usually in
noir novel.
Noir novel, yeah.
Yeah,
it's about the politics in Spain, and it's absolutely different. So maybe those are the first novels. Maybe I will write science again. I don't know. But I don't like to. Have the sticker, I don't know if this expression is correct here in America, have the sticker of science fiction writer.
Yeah, because I know you began by writing essays and had some success in that and short stories before you made the move to fiction. Let me back up just a bit and ask you this as well. One of the most interesting things on your website about your biology is the travel that you have done. You said that when you finished school in Madrid, you thought it was perhaps time to see the world.
Yeah.
And you have been successful in that. Only in the pictures, I know that there are photos of you standing on Iguazu Falls on the border of Brazil and Argentina. And I have stood in that exact place, by the way. You've made several trips to Egypt. There is a photograph of you in the Serengeti in Tanzania. Another one in the Inca capital of Cusco, which plays a prominent role, I know, in your book that won the 2009 prize. Another one with San tribesmen from Namibia in front of Petra in Jordan at a park in Kenya. And lastly, with a giant anaconda wrapped around your neck. I will say there is no London,
and no
Paris, no New York City, none of the usual things that tourists might do. There's something I know that ties together all of those places. And what is it that you get from travel to such exotic, wild, and occasionally dangerous places? And then how does that work in your last two novels?
Yeah, well, those are interest places. For example, in Namibia, I have the opportunity to spend some weeks with the San etnia. Those are Bosquimanos. How do you call them?
The Bushmen.
Bushmen, yeah, that is. And those are one of the oldest group in the world. I mean, they come directly from our ancestors. And it was really, really interesting. Well, it was also dangerous because I remember we were watching a cave with some petroglyphs in it. And then we hear something in the bush, and it finally was a leopard.
Oh.
And we were, between the car and us, and we have any weapon with us, so.
And you didn't get a picture of the leopard around your neck like you did the anaconda somewhere else.
No, I hope someone couldn't take this picture.
Yeah. So your last two novels, I know one takes place in Cusco in 2009 or around that area of the Inca Empire, talks a bit about the origins of pre-Columbian empires.
Yeah.
Let me ask you more about the last novel, though, Yeti. Where is that set and why? And what is it about the Yeti that is so compelling in some ways, both to you and to lots of cultures around the world?
Well, there are a lot of references for the Yeti, but you have different kinds of Yeti in all the parts of the world. It's really interesting. There are books, for example, for Ivan Sanderson, which is one writer who recopilated all those sightings, avistamientos.
Sightings, yeah.
And you can have a lot of different kinds. One of the most interesting for me is the one who lives, who knows if it's really alive, but who lives in Sumatra. It was one of the most incredible forests in the world, in the equatorial area, and it's some kind of in exploration still in this area. And I thought that it would be one of the most probable places to have this kind of signs. For example, in an island near Sumatra in Flores, some years ago, they found a new kind of hominid. I mean the...
Oh, the hobbits.
The hobbits, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And that was, I think, what, 5 or 6 years ago? Maybe a slightly longer. But yeah, it was a race that had flourished and then died of people that were about 3.5, 4 feet tall, something like that.
Yeah, right? and the rest were too recent. They are talking about 12,000 years, which is nothing. So maybe they are in some of this forest. One or some of these groups alive in areas which still are not exploiting for the Occidental men.
Yeah, and I remember with Florensis that, interestingly enough, there were oral narratives and folk tales about this other people that had disappeared, this short people, and that those were floating around and had been gathered by some anthropologists and others before they actually discovered the cave where these bodies were. So the memory of these people was still there.
Well,
on the
island. But not only the memory. If you ask the bushmen of Sumatra, the Orang Rimba, they told you that when they're in the forest and they build a little campament, it's okay?
Camp.
A camp, yeah. They build a little camp. They will eat some things in the border of the camp, for example, honey or tobacco. So when the Orang Pendek, the hominid, come, they will take this and leave them alone. If not, in the middle of the night, it will appear, it will begin to shake the shelters, it will crash all the pots and all that kind of things.
Yeah, it sounds a little bit like the unseen monster in the woods in Lost, TV series in the United States. And the point is that, I guess in many ways, right, the possibility of the existence of another kind of human is still real to the people of Sumatra and real in your book as well.
Yeah, but you have to think that, for example, the last year, and it used to happen every 2 years, one new ethnia of Bushmen in Amazons was found. I mean, we are always finding new species, new groups of humans in those remote areas. And the sightings in Sumatra are constant from more than one century ago.
Yeah.
And, well, it may be possible. Why not?
Yeah, and I guess it's the maybe, the possibility of that, that's more important in some ways than the literal scientific validity or not.
Yeah.
In terms of literature and what's possible and what can be imagined.
Yeah, well, that's the reason, because I write a novel, you know, instead of an essay. It's for the possibility, and truth is that I like to think that it's possible. I mean, I like to believe that the magic of the work is still present.
So again, if you want to do science, then you go and do science.
Yeah.
If you want to tweak your brain a bit or think about something else in a more imaginative realm, it seems like the kind of writing you're doing.
Yeah, that is exactly.
Is where you might go for that. Dale, let me ask you this. I know that a literary critic might say that writing about monsters and about extraterrestrials in some ways is an indirect manner of establishing human identity, what the borders of the human are. This is exactly, I know, the kind of thing that you do in the other books that you've looked at. How does Fernando's work, or even other things in this genre, do you think, have something to say about that topic of human identity?
Well, what I really like about Yeti is that we have Mario, the hero, who he belongs in the forest. He loves to work in nature. He's like somebody like Mike Whiting here on campus, who goes to New Guinea and loves to find all those bugs, takes his students there, just loves that stuff, and then is able to do some other discoveries here in the lab, but he's much rather be out in the woods, as it were, in the bush. And because he's more of a natural man, a person of nature, he's very comfortable there, he's able to sort of bridge the border between these other folks who are trying to come in and exploit nature. Rather than exploit it, he wants to, well, first he wants to preserve the biodiversity, and he ultimately faces this terrible moral choice in the whether to sort of destroy this little tribe of people that he's found in the middle, because he knows that if he reveals their presence to the world, they'll be destroyed. Just like this, the people in Brazil, the Stone Age tribes in Brazil.
Yeah, I was going to say this is not entirely imaginative, because those are issues that are going on right now in Brazil and Ecuador and some other places that have, unfortunately, great oil reserves in the middle of the Amazon basin.
Yeah, and in this case, it's to basically, if he does that, then he's able to save modern humanity because of a plague that's covering a pandemic that's covering the world. In all of these novels, there are a number of novelists and story writers in Spain who have envisioned sort of caveman or species of humans that aren't our own, that have survived down through the ages. Some of them have survived into modern times. There's one, Leon Arsenal has a group that has survived sort of as beggars in society. They've perfectly adapted to society, our modern society, and they're beggars, or they live in the dump or something like that, homeless folks. And, I mean, it sounds, that's not a very good characterization. It sounds racist, as it's not. It's just a very, very well thing, because these people are perfectly adapted to what they do. Another novelist, sort of has these folks that are immortal. They're not vampires. There's just a guy who was born in a cave 28,000 years ago and he's still alive. He's not like Mel Brooks, the 2,000-year-old man or anything like that. He just has lots of knowledge. So these guys help us define what a normal or the average human being is, but they also expand what we understand to be human and help us to see how we work with nature. Nature isn't just a resource to be consumed, a standing reserve there waiting for us to mold it and shape it and use it, but we belong to nature, and we may well have stewardship over the world, but that stewardship is also stewardship for ourselves. You know, we have to take care of ourselves in nature.
So, Fernando, when you were writing about Sumatra and earlier about the Inca empires and where they had lived, do you feel like you have some kind of an agenda, perhaps? Not even conscious, but you must, I assume, partly from your background and even your travel and your current interests, have a vested interest in maintaining the biodiversity of these areas that you go to. And I say that noting that oil companies are an enemy in some of your novels as well, in part because they want to ruin the very thing that the characters are trying to preserve.
Yeah. And actually, it's not real fiction. I mean, when we were ready to publish the book and we were preparing all the briefing for the press in Spain, it appears that a company from Europe, a petroleum company from Europe, which actually is trying to make a biofuel. Yeah, biofuel is correct.
Biofuel,
yeah, that is. Won an international prize about be the most dangerous company in the world. And it actually was trying to make some plantation of biofuel in Sumatra, actually. So it's not a real, it's not a far fiction. I mean, it's so close to the reality. And yeah, I want to preserve these places. I explore this way in one of my early books, in La Sexta Extinción, which was a scientific essay who warns about the problems that our planet have. And one of them was the deforestation and the lack of biodiversity. That's the name. The Sexta Extinción is the next big extinction, which is actually now happening. But it happens so slow that we humans cannot feel it. But when you see all the numbers, it's evident. We are now in this moment suffering a big extinction of a species. So when I write the Yeti, I think that it will be a good motto for the characters and the main characters to fight for.
Yeah. Tell me about the technique of your work, and Dale, feel free to chip in on this also. Critics say that you pull all the literary tricks that exist in the book of writers. Another one say that you're always consistently pushing the boundaries of whatever genre you're writing in. And I assume you'll do the same in the noir fiction or the police fiction that you do next. But how do you use the ability to do different things in kind of a postmodern world that writers take advantage of? What is it that you do, or how do you use these other structures to somehow get a point across or tell your story?
Well, actually, I don't have any academic formation for write, you know. But I like to read a lot, and it's some kind of... How do you call when something is not prepared? It just flows. It just appears.
Yeah, spontaneous, perhaps.
Yeah, that is. It's spontaneous, and I like to write the way I'm having some fun. I mean, when I finish a chapter and I got a cliffhanger, in the next chapter I begin to tell another different kind of things. And I know that the reader will be waiting for this thing to be resolved. And it's so funny for me to write this way. And actually it works for them also.
Well, clearly readers are having fun with it.
Yeah. That's right.
As are the jury of the important prizes in Spain, who've awarded you again some significant awards already on your career as that begins. Fernando Lopez del Oso and Del Pratt, thank you for coming to talk to us today on Thinking Aloud.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure.
If you read Spanish, we'd encourage you to get Fernando's books. Again, the most famous now are El Templo de la Luna and the Yeti, El Yeti. They will be available within a few years in translation. This has been Mark Burns, filling in for Marcus Smith on Thinking Aloud. More on today's show can be found at classical89.org/thinkingaloud, where you'll find additional information, including past programs and podcasts. Thinking Aloud is also now on Facebook and Twitter. We welcome any comments at our email address, thinkingaloud@byu.edu. Our student producers are Kylan Rice and Rachel Sherman. Thinking Aloud airs weekdays at 11 a.m. and 8 p.m. Mountain Time, and is also on BYU's Sirius XM radio channel at about 11:30 a.m. and 6:30 p.m. on a near daily basis.
Aloud is a production of BYU Broadcasting, made possible in cooperation with the Brigham Young University Division of Continuing Education.